You were right. Riley noticed Goolsbee, white as a sheet, the MP officer seeing that as well. Done this before, Lieutenant. Any dame with a bunch of men, she's either a sex slave or, well, one of these. Seen an officer's wife once traveling with her man, handling a machine gun like a pro. These two, they'd kill you quicker than any man. They can't do much now. There's a truck down the road. We'll load 'em up. Goolsbee nodded dumbly, and Welch said to the MP, Appreciate it, sir. I'll make sure Lieutenant McCarthy knows about you helping us out. There'll probably be a few more of these folks to handle up ahead. The MP made a quick nod, moved away, the other MPs motioning the prisoners into line, marching them into captivity. Riley watched Goolsbee again, the young lieutenant trying to gather himself. On the road, more Marines were moving up, the rest of the platoon, another platoon behind them. The prisoners had their full attention, the men offering a chorus of catcalls and hoots. Lieutenant McCarthy was there, and with him Captain Zorn. Zorn moved up closer to Goolsbee, said in a low voice, Let's move out, Lieutenant. This is protocol. No atrocities here. Goolsbee lowered his head, said, Yes, sir. Absolutely. Zorn called out, Fox! Third platoon will lead the way. Keep it close. Dark in an hour, and we're moving up in support of 1st Battalion. We'll make camp in a field up ahead. Good work with the prisoners. Move out! The men were all in motion now, two parallel lines spread out to either side of the narrow road. The talk started again, laughter, and Riley knew the jokes would come next, the big talkers talking big. He picked up the rhythm of the footsteps in front of him, kept his distance behind Welch, Killian falling in across the road, the routine of the march. South of Weijongbu, October 3, 1950. The foxholes were dug, but this time the men didn't have to rely on sea rations. With Seoul secure, the trucks had come up in support, bringing all manner of supplies, including one of those marvelous luxuries every Marine hoped for, hot food. Weijongbu had been quiet for a while now, darkness offering what seemed to be a peaceful night. The Marines closer to the town making more efficient progress than had been made in Seoul. The men of Zorn's company were spread out alongside other companies of the 7th, McCarthy's 3rd Platoon, grateful for the order to enjoy the meal provided by someone higher up the chain of command. Men were moving about in the darkness, some dropping down into their holes. The click of weapon checks, canteens, low chatty talk. A few yards from Riley, Welch sat against an old tree stump, his knees bent, seemed to be writing, and to one side of him Killian was doing the same. Riley thought of the mail call late that afternoon, Killian finally getting his wife's package. Riley watched them both for a long, quiet moment, said, Hey, how can you two see what you're writing? It's dark, for Christ's sakes. Welch ignored him. But the big Irishman took the bait.
You got something to say, you don't need to see the paper. It just comes out. Poetic, too, some of it. She'll appreciate it, for sure.
If you say so. Didn't know we had a poet in the outfit. How about you, Sarge?
Shut up. I'm thinking.
Riley thought of Killian's package. Hey, Sean, you inclined to share any of that stuff from home? Killian looked up.
Yeah, sure. Cookies. Want one? All I got left is oatmeal. Hammered the sugar cookies soon as I got 'em. Do that every damn time. Brain tells me, hey, stupid, save some, but my mouth says, just give me the whole batch.
He shuffled through his backpack, pulled out a small box, leaned out, Riley meeting him halfway. Thanks. I owe you one.
Yep, you do. When these are gone, no telling when she'll send more. Took her a month to send these, and I've been begging in every damn letter I write.
Maybe the poetry will help.
Can't hurt.
Welch looked up from his own letter, said,
Both of you are going to end up squatting over that stinking latrine. I've seen more jarheads get the trots from home packages than from sea rations. Your gut's not used to soft living.
Killian said, Cookie Sarge?
Welch didn't hesitate. Sure, thanks.
Morelli came up through the darkness, always in a hurry.
Hey, Sarge, where's my foxhole? This one?
To one side, the BAR man, Kane.
Over here, kid. Geez, somebody get him a map.
Killian looked up at Morelli, said,
Hey, kid, you play poker?
No, not really. Played a little on the ship over here. Lost a week's pay.
The Irishman laughed.
That's how it's supposed to work. You pay for the privilege of a good time getting to know your comrades. Beats doing nothing.
Maybe. Could have used that pay. My mom is expecting it. Says she's counting on it every month.
Riley wanted to ask. Let it go. But Killian wasn't so discreet.
So you live with your mama?
Bet you got a house full of bambinos. And a hot little sister, too, I bet. She like Irishmen?
Killian laughed, and Riley couldn't help a smile, Welch chuckling as well. The others were offering up comments of their own, and Riley began to feel sorry for Morelli, standing still in the dark. Thought, I can see how red his face is from here. He slipped down into the foxhole, said, It's okay, kid. They need somebody to rag. For now, you're it. We get more replacements, it'll be your turn to dish it out. You'll be the veteran. Morelli knelt down close to Riley, said in a low voice,
It's okay. I like it, sorta. He's right, though. I live with my folks back in Jersey. No sister, though, just four brothers. One older. He's in politics.
Riley looked at Morelli through the darkness.
What's that mean?
He figured out how to keep from coming over here. Knows people. I told him I signed up on purpose. He went nuts. Said he could have had me put into any job I wanted. He thinks he's going to be mayor of Jersey City someday.
Yeah, great. I'm with you. I'd rather be a jarhead.
Morelli sat close beside him now, keeping his voice low.
You married, Pete?
Yep. Christmas makes 5 years. Little Ruthie.
He smiled, let the image flow into him.
Tiny thing. 5 feet nothing. Miss her like hell. My boy, too.
You got a son?
Peter Jr. He'll turn 4 soon. She won't let me call him Pete. Says he's going to be more respectable than his old man. Get a good education, not like me. She says there's no way he's going to grow up a Marine. Only one man in the family allowed to spend his days getting shot at. We had a few rounds about that one. I said let the boy make up his own mind. He smiled, shook his head. Here's some advice for you, kid. Choose carefully what you want to argue about. Best to let them have their way more often than not. When it matters to you, really matters, well then, okay, stand up. Keeps the peace. Peace is good, I promise you. Grew up with war. Every damn day. Pop and Mama raising hell about nothing at all. Bad stuff there.
What'd they fight about?
Riley brought himself back to the moment, the darkness, low sounds around him. None of your damn business. What do you want to know this stuff for anyway? The boy lowered his head, leaned closer still, a quiet voice.
I gotta tell you, Pete, those MPs today, I never seen that before. None of it.
Riley wasn't sure what he meant, said, Not likely any of us have seen too much of that. The enemy is bad people.
No, I mean, I never seen that. Naked women and all. I couldn't look too long. That must have felt awful embarrassing. All us men watching them. I was raised Catholic. My mama...
Killian was there now, easing into the foxhole. There was no whisper in the man, his voice booming.
How embarrassed would you be if one of those bitches stuck a grenade in your ear? It's the enemy, kid. Get used to it. Any nooks capture you, they'll stick your rosary beads up your ass. You been paying attention? You see what kind of things they done to their own kind? What's your Bible say about heathens? Welch called over. Enough! You're waking up the whole battalion. Can't concentrate on my letter. Riley said, Who's that one to? Doreen or Janice? Not sure yet. Maybe Ellen. I put the name on last, depending on my mood. Riley leaned back against the side of the hole, said to Morelli, Let go of it, kid. If that's the worst thing you see over here, you'll be lucky. Besides, I bet God forgives you for looking. Hell, he made those women, right? He made your eyeballs, right? Morelli seemed to absorb that, thought a moment.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, well, yeah.
Killian shifted his weight in the hole, his rifle up beside him. Unless you're here to play poker, go to bed, kid. You're getting on my nerves. Morelli leaned low to Riley, said,
Thank you, Pete. Night.
He moved off, and Riley said to Killian, Where'd you get cards? I'll play some. You'll have to tell me what's on my cards, though. Don't know what all those pictures mean. All that other stuff, diamonds and whatnot. Welch laughed, crawled over closer. Hey, Irish, you be careful with this one. He cleaned out half the swabbies on the way over here. I think he grew up in a casino or something. Riley laughed. Just like to play a friendly game, Sarge. It was against orders on the ship, you know. Still is. Killian said, Not quite, Sarge. It was forbidden. Not quite the same thing as an order. I took 20 off a lieutenant at Baker Company. Goolsby was there now, the small man coming through the darkness with soft steps.
Let's get some sleep if we can. Captain Zorn has ordered one-quarter watch, and Lieutenant McCarthy assigned Sergeant Welch to pick out the man for first watch. 2-hour shifts.
Welch said, Irish will take the first watch. I'll relieve him in 2 hours. Riley can be next. I'll do the fourth. Don't need much sleep. Kane, Baxter, that'll get us to dawn.
Goolsby said, Very good. See to it, Sergeant.
He moved away. More instructions to the next squad. Killian pulled himself up, said, Now those are orders. See you in 2 hours, Sarge. Welch ignored the sarcasm, crawled away, and Riley said,
Night, Sarge.
He shifted his weight, tried to find any kind of comfortable position. Knew Killian would be sharp, wide-eyed. He's loud and a jerk sometimes, he thought, but he's a good Marine. Riley closed his eyes, visions of the prisoners, naked bodies and hateful stares. Thought of the kid, the shame of it. He'll learn, I hope. Or maybe not.
He goes home with no more of a nightmare than that. I don't care what his mama says. He'll be the luckiest son of a bitch in the Corps.
He felt sleep coming, the weariness of the last few days seeping through him. To one side, a voice, jarring, a few yards away, singing, Good night, Irene. I'll see you in my dreams. Killian stood up. Oh, for God's sake, who the hell is doing that? I heard that damn song all the way over here, and I ain't listening to it now. There was silence for a moment, then the voice of Lieutenant Goolsby.
Sorry, just rather like the song.
Killian sat again, and Riley fought to quiet his own laughter, leaned toward the Irishman. Nice going, Private. He'd bust you, except you're already as low as you can get. How about you save all that heat for the enemy? Killian whispered,
Oh, for Christ's sake. You think he knows it was me?
Welch called over from his own hole. Don't worry, Irish. I'll tell him in the morning.
Huizhongbu, October 4th, 1950. The men of Fox Company were patrolling again, as they had near Incheon.
the sounds of the fight replaced by the occasional burst from a distant machine gun, a thump of artillery somewhere to the north. Above, squadrons of corsairs roared past, searching for targets, their power adding to the morale of the men on the ground. Riley glanced up, six planes in a loose formation high above, moving north. He always wondered about the pilots. The glamour job, thought. Lucky bastards. They don't ever have to smell this place. He couldn't get used to the stink from the rice paddies, but Weizhong Bu offered new smells. Even worse. The reasons for that were everywhere. Decaying bodies buried beneath blasted homes. Some were North Koreans left behind, rotting where they had died. But there were others. Civilians, caught in the firefights, trapped by the shelling with nowhere else to go. Up ahead was a row of crude huts, burnt, whether by design or by the chance impact of an artillery round. Smoke rose from smoldering straw. Another squad of Marines moving out that way, careful inspection, but there were few places the enemy could hide. McCarthy was pointing, and Sergeant Welch looked back, motioned in front of him. This way. The rest of the squad followed him, stepping off the road, and Riley eyed a flattened fence line, more huts beyond. More of the awful smell washed over him now, a new kind of putrid, his face twisting, a hard exhale, futile effort to keep the stink away. Welch reacted as well, turning his head, and behind him, groans from the others. Welch led them between two huts, one smashed flat as though punched by a giant fist. He pointed toward the other, a heap of mangled straw. "Check it out." Riley peered through a gap, what remained of someone's home. "Nothing, Sarge." Welch didn't answer, kept his eyes on whatever lay ahead, and behind Riley, a voice. "Killian." "Oh, good Christ." Riley turned quickly, saw the big Irishman staring out to one side toward a heap of freshly churned earth. Welch moved that way, and beside Riley, another man, Harper, nearly as green as Morelli.
"It's a cow. Ox, I guess."
The southern drawl was unmistakable, and Killian stepped closer, stared at the decaying mass, swarms of flies, said,
"You sure? How the hell you know that? You a farm boy?"
"Yep. Seen plenty of dead cows. This one's poorer, though. Sack of bones."
Riley avoided looking at the carnage, said,
"It's no use to anybody now."
"Hey, Sarge, over that way, people by those huts." Welch said,
"Let's see what's up."
Riley followed the sergeant, stepped over debris, all of them still cautious. The stink was even worse now, and Riley shook his head, thought, "How much of this can these people stand?" The civilians stood in a cluster, a dozen of them, watching the Marines move closer. It was the usual scene, old men in ragged white clothes, old women standing back behind them. There were children, dead stares, hints of fear, tears on dirty faces. Behind him, Killian said,
"What the hell's over there?"
Welch turned, motioned them forward, said,
"For the love of God."
It spread out before all of them now, the sight every man dreaded, a mass grave. Riley glimpsed the half-decayed bodies, pieces of flesh, black blood and grotesque faces, dark bones covered with swarms of flies. He felt his stomach pull up into a tight curl, one man grunting behind him, dropping to his knees, vomiting. Riley closed his eyes for a brief moment. Another sight he didn't need to absorb. He backed away, the rest of the squad doing the same. Looked again to the civilians, standing off to one side, mostly silent, the soft whimper of a single child.
Welch said. We've got to report this. Get a good look. Look for uniforms, south or north.
Riley let out a breath, tried to detach himself from the scene. It's just death, he thought. Do your damn job. The grave was shallow, not much of a grave at all, most of the bodies protruding, blackened limbs, hands with crooked fingers. Rain had drained away much of their cover, grim evidence that most of the bodies were without clothes. Killian said,
No uniforms, Sarge. These folks were executed. Bullet holes in the heads.
Riley saw the same, then more. Tiny forms, hard against adult bodies. Welch said,
Oh, Christ, babies. They've been killed with their mothers. Looks like bayonet wounds. Enough of this.
He looked toward the civilians, Riley backing away, doing the same. There was no emotion from the old men, a strange calm. Welch said,
These people were butchered, bullet holes in the heads. Who did this? You speak English? Who did this?
One old man raised his arm slowly, pointed up the road to the north. Killian said,
Nooks, I knew it.
Welch glanced at him, disgust on his face.
Yeah, genius, you figured it out. I'm getting damn sick of this stuff. This isn't war. It's a horror show. I seen too much of this from the Japs.
Welch started to move again, past the civilians, back toward the road. Riley stepped up, closed the gap between them, said,
You ought to tell the captain, I guess. Somebody's got to make a report. The lieutenant, at least.
Welch didn't look at him.
Another genius. You think this is one time? Something special? These damned savages can't whip our asses, so they take it out on the innocent. Somebody explain to me why. What the hell are these damn Koreans so hot for that they slaughter civilians?
Riley had rarely seen Welch this emotional. Had no response. He followed the sergeant back toward the road, the others falling into line, keeping their distance, their good training, all of them sharing the same hope that the North Koreans had truly gone, that the misery of these people could finally end. Uijongbu, October 7th, 1950. The army troops marched past, the usual catcalls, the Marines answering. But these soldiers were veterans, too, most of them from units of the 8th Army, the men who had advanced from the Pusan perimeter, now marching northward. For 3 days since Uijongbu had been cleared of the enemy, the Marines had strengthened their position in the town, more an army of occupation than anything resembling a combat mission. Now the army was moving into position to take their place. The rumors were hot that orders had come for the Marines to pull back, speculation that with the fighting concluded the enemy had surrendered. They had gathered at another of the kitchen trucks, enormous buckets of stew, bread, apple pies in stacks, generous slices to each man. Riley did what the others did, heaped his tin plate, seeking out a comfortable place on the rocky ground, another feast he knew not to take for granted.
Hey, jarheads, listen up.
He forced the pie down his throat, the delicious moment interrupted by the cluster of officers standing nearby. He focused first on the familiar face, Captain Zorn, his hands on his hips.
All right, listen up. Get your gear together. Orders from division. The whole lot of us are being trucked back down to Incheon, the port.
The cheering erupted, but Riley saw a frown on Zorn's face. Knew there was more. Beside Zorn, another officer, familiar from battalion, one of Major Sawyer's men, who said,
You men have done exemplary work. You should be proud. We've all had a job to do, and that job has been accomplished.
We going home?
The call came from behind Riley, Moore joining in, the cheering again. But Riley kept his eyes on Zorn's face, so saw the man slowly shake his head. Zorn waited for quiet again, then said,
No. Get that straight, all of you. This job's not done. We're to wait at Inchon for new orders, telling us where they want us to be. I wish I could tell you we're done here, that our next port of call is San Diego, but the orders only said Inchon. Sounds to me like they're not done with us. That's all I know.
Zorn said something to the officer, who moved away with a sharp nod, and Riley watched him go, thought, he's telling the other companies the same thing. Zorn stood alone now, his arms crossed, watching them, his eye catching Riley. The talk flowed through them all now, rumors springing up from fertile minds, the raw hope that the gloom from Zorn was just part of the job, keeping his company's feet on the ground. Zorn seemed to recognize him, the acknowledgement of a veteran, but Riley did not smile, saw no reason to. He doesn't know what's up, Riley thought. They haven't told him. But I bet he's right. This job isn't done. He glanced around, saw Welch, his hands in his knapsack, organizing. What do you think, Hemp? Welch kept his stare downward, said,
Nobody surrendered, Pete. We let those bastards get away. We should have clamped them down in Seoul, wiped them off the earth, every damn one of them. But we let them slip off. Now we got to go find them again.
But if they went home, back into North Korea, Welch looked at him, hard, cold eyes.
So what? We took casualties, Pete. Men died. Marines. Soldiers. The people back home will want to know what the hell for. Somebody's got to tell them something good, whether it's newspapers or the government. Just saying, hey, everything's fine now. The North Koreans, they all went back home. That ain't gonna do it, Pete. We gotta kill some more people. Plain and simple.
Riley looked toward Zorn again, saw the captain standing quietly, arms still crossed, his stare outward to some other place. Whatever might lay ahead. Part 2. I hope we do not have to operate in this country in the winter. Major General Oliver P. Smith to his wife, October 1, 1950. Chapter 7. Smith. On board the USS Mount McKinley, October 11, 1950. The steam rolled up around him, wet, glorious heat, the soapy lather sweeping away days of grime. He inhaled deeply, pulling the delicious steam inside of him, breathed it out slowly. His arms hung now by his sides, and he leaned his head forward under the shower, blinded by the waterfall that flowed down his face, rinsing away the soap. He opened his eyes, saw a pool of sudsy water at his feet. A slow drift downward through the drain. He allowed himself another few seconds of the watery massage, but could not avoid his mind snapping to attention, the harsh reality slapping him that this was only a temporary luxury, a gift from the ship's captain, the privilege of rank. He reluctantly turned the shower off, blinked water from his eyes, paused, took in another long breath, the last of the warm steam. Memories of home, more luxuries, all those pieces of life with Esther. He stepped clear of the shower, his brain waging war with itself, one part of him knowing he could slide once more into the torrent of hot water that no one would question, no one would find fault. But none of this steamy escape could remove the reality of what was happening beyond the bulkheads, the curiosity of his men, the entire division still waiting at Inchon for the order that would put them aboard the ships, following their general to their next port of call. And for them, there would be no hot showers. Smith knew the rumors,
the wishful thinking that rippled through the camps at Incheon, that their job was complete. He had ordered his staff to stop that kind of talk, that this war was still theirs to fight. But he could do nothing to stop the euphoria that came from above, the back-slapping congratulations flowing out from MacArthur's headquarters, so many untested officers in Tokyo completely convinced that they had won a war. The celebration had spread through the upper levels of the 10th Corps, a message coming to Smith from Ned Almond that offered effusive praise for a job well done. He had tried to imagine Almond's expression as he wrote the note, whether the man believed his own kindness or whether Almond wrote with a hard grip on his pen, scowling acceptance that the Marines had earned the praise. Smith tried to avoid meeting with Almond at all, a foolish hope. The Marines still firmly anchored as a part of Almond's command. Smith dressed quickly, the dread returning. He buttoned up with jerking fingers, tugged the trousers up, the loose waistband revealing his loss of weight. He thought of writing that to Esther, but he knew it would inspire concern, worry that he was not eating well, or worse, that he had picked up some Asian malady. No, he thought, she does not deserve worry. But I will write. After all, it is good news, all of it. Success. But I must be honest with her, clear away the junk. She knows full well not to believe what she reads in the newspapers. And Time magazine, good Lord, what is the matter with those people? I'm no hero, not even close. The Marines were the best prepared men we could put into the field, and I happen to be at the top. It's no different now than the First World War. Marines called upon to serve as infantry. The Fifth led the way at Belleau Wood. I need to make sure Murray knows that, make sure he tells his men their own history. It's important, though right now their morale is about as high as it can be, and it's my job to stick a pin in that balloon. He was fully dressed now, checked himself in the captain's small mirror. Satisfactory. I must thank him for this, he thought. For the first time in many days, I don't smell like Korea. He moved out into the passageway, sailors standing aside, crisp salutes, which he returned. He climbed to the next deck, saw officers, Marines in a small cluster, cigarettes and coffee cups. They noticed him immediately, faces smiling. Eddie Craig. Well, General, you look a good bit more presentable. Fit even by MacArthur's standards. He acknowledged the smiles with a brief nod, said, "The staff will meet in the wardroom in 10 minutes, if you please. I'd like to know our status. I'll request the captain be there as well." He caught a whiff of something pungent, saw Sexton backing away slightly, self-conscious. "Make that 30 minutes. I would appreciate it if you gentlemen would see to your personal hygiene. Even a damp rag will do." It was his attempt at a joke, but there was no laughter, the men responding with brief sniffs at their clothing. He could rarely tell a joke, found it difficult to break that pane of glass between them. Craig and Bowser seemed to be the exceptions, but here even Bowser kept his seriousness. "Aye, sir. If I can find my clean uniform, I'll change. We'll make ourselves more presentable. Sorry." Craig said, "There wasn't much time, but you're certainly correct, sir. We could all use a scrub down." Smith regretted the comment now. Didn't want them to think he was scolding them for anything at all. But he had no use for excuses. "Any effort will be fine. 30 minutes, then." He reached another ladder, climbed up to the open deck, a breeze of fresh salt air. He stepped carefully to the port side rail, the ship rolling over heavy swells, and he saw the land spread out along the horizon, the coastline of South Korea. "It can't take us too long," he thought. "The captain will tell me when we pass the boundary." I wonder how the men will react. Word will spread on the transports, some sailor making sure the Marines find out when they cross the line. No need for secrets here. The 38th parallel might not mean much to them. The land won't look any different from out here. Likely no one will be shooting at them either. If the South Koreans have done their job, the landing will go smoothly. No enemy anywhere around. There will be one thing very different from Incheon, though. Something even the new men will understand. This time we're not liberators. We're invaders. He had left the Marines at Incheon making preparations for the voyage, supplies distributed, equipment gathered, the officers seeing to their commands, the men seeing to themselves. They would sail as he was sailing, around the bottom of the Korean peninsula, eastward, then up to the North Korean port of Wonsan. There the Marines would make yet another landing, securing the port, establishing a base for the next operation. He felt in his pocket the unfinished letters, one to each of his two daughters. Get that done tonight, he thought. Esther, too. They're all showing off that magazine cover, sure as the dickens. Rather, they didn't do that. He thought of his granddaughter, Gail. Yes, she's probably taken that thing to school, waving it around like a flag for all to see. He shook his head. No, let them be proud. He heard the sound of engines, looked up, a pair of B-29s high above, and he eyed the direction, thought, Japan, going home, empty probably. Aim well, gentlemen. But a new thought jolted him, as it had so many times before. The young man's face, a burst of cold, dragged into his mind by the sight of the big bombers. You should be here, he thought. That should be you, up in those marvelous birds. The plane had gone down just before Christmas, 1944. His son-in-law, Charles Benedict, listed officially as missing in action. Benedict had been flying a bombing mission over Mukden, China, the word coming to his family that there was little hope of the crew's survival. The pain of that had been overwhelming. Smith stationed then in Hawaii, so far from home, unable to do anything to comfort his daughter, Virginia. The helplessness of his absence had stayed with him, and so he would never forget to write them, could never escape the nagging fear that if something happened to him, they might not hear of it for many weeks. The horrible coldness of a telegram. He tapped the folded papers in his pocket. Tonight. Get them done. Tell them only good things. They can read about Ned Almond in the newspaper. Well, General, I was told you were enjoying the captain's hospitality. Feel better, I assume? The voice was cheerful, the expression on the man's smiling face always seeming sincere. General Lowe. Yes, the captain was most kind. You should take advantage of it yourself. Surely he would not object. Oh, I have, I assure you, even before we set sail. One thing I have learned quickly is that naval vessels have no shortage of hot water. Their food seems to be superior as well. No offense to your staff, of course. Smith felt Lowe's good cheer, turned again to the horizon, thought, what have we told the president today? Lowe moved up beside him, anchored himself to the rail with unsteady hands. A slight waver. Smith watched him, said, Are you feeling all right, General? Please, I do wish you could get past your need for such rigidity. It's frank. I'm perfectly happy to greet you as General Smith, but when you call me General, I'm not altogether comfortable having anyone believing me to be your equal. I'll try, Frank. Are you all right? You mean the waves? The captain advises me to get lots of fresh air and keep my eyes on the horizon. It has seemed to help.
Not sure I enjoy sleeping below deck, though.
Stay up here. We'll get you a cot. He's right. The fresh air will help.
Lowe took a deep breath, said, Damn embarrassing, you know. Never really been a problem for me before. I can't really tell Mr. Truman that his envoy has a weak stomach.
You think MacArthur has ever been seasick?
It was a strange question, and Smith detected more meaning than Lowe might have intended.
No idea.
I'll bet General Almond has tossed his lunch a few times.
Seems the type.
You expecting a response, General?
Frank?
Lowe seemed genuinely surprised.
Not at all.
No games here, General. But to be honest, there is concern in Washington that General MacArthur is relying on his unshakable belief in his own infallibility. There were expectations that Inchon would be his final bow, that he would have no choice but to allow others to take the reins.
Why?
Lowe tilted his head. You are not naive, General. You know that MacArthur is not as popular in Washington as he is in the newspapers. He is rather convinced that his way of running things is the only way, and he does not pay much heed to anyone who disagrees with him. The man has been a general in this army for more than 30 years. Things can happen to a man who is always in charge, who is never confronted by argument. He has surrounded himself with those who worship him. What does that do to a man?
I don't know. Do you?
Lowe paused. It is an uncomfortable situation. I have received word, and not just from the president, mind you. The Joint Chiefs are afraid of the man. MacArthur tells them what he intends to do, and they decide they'll allow it. Not sure what would happen if they decided not to.
That's not my concern, General.
Lowe looked at him. Another pause. No, I suppose not. However, I would very much like your view on what is happening right now.
What do you mean?
Your division has been ordered to make a landing in North Korea. Already, South Korean troops are pushing north of the 38th parallel, and reports say they are receiving little resistance. There is hope that those troops might end this thing without our own people crossing that border. It concerns me that General MacArthur seems not to care about borders at all. He's giving General Almond another opportunity for headlines. That's how some see it. Ned the Anointed, they call him.
Careful, Smith thought.
He's testing you.
Hadn't heard that.
Lowe seemed to read him, said, Come now, General. I'm not here to pin you down, put your seat in hot water. It's my job to understand what is going on here beyond the piffle Tokyo hands out. I need you to be honest with me, and I assure you our discussions are in confidence.
You, me, and the President.
Your commander-in-chief. Doesn't he deserve your honesty as well? Certainly your insights. Your position here is crucial to the success of this campaign, and your performance. Almond knows that. He's watching you like a hawk, but he's protected. MacArthur's hand on his shoulder, warding off any criticism. Not so General Walker. Do you know the man?
Some.
Walton Walker can't be happy, wouldn't you agree? Smith searched for the right words.
If I was Walton Walker, 3 stars, and I was told that a 2-star, Ned Almond, would not answer to me, that he would operate a separate independent command, I would probably ask why.
And the answer?
You would have to ask General MacArthur.
Lowe leaned again on the rail, seemed more at ease now. It's no secret, not even to you, that MacArthur dislikes Walton Walker. Doesn't trust him. Walker's done okay, served his men well around Pusan, but his headquarters is a mess. Disorganized, men running around with no clear notion of their objectives or how to obtain them. Smith was surprised by that, kept it to himself.
I'm not familiar with General Walker's methods.
No, and you won't be. Not any time soon. You answer to Ormond and only Ormond. And Ormond answers only to MacArthur. Walton Walker and his 8th Army might as well be on the moon.
It might feel like that before too long.
You want me to give you my view about my orders, about the next part of this campaign. You need me to explain to you what MacArthur's doing?
You already know.
Perhaps. I'd prefer hearing it from you.
Let's just say the president wants to know who's paying attention.
Smith let out a breath, looked hard at Lowe.
I'm not pleased with your questions, General Lowe.
Perhaps it is the answers that bother you.
Smith stared out, thought, perhaps it is.
He looked again at Lowe, saw nothing to give him doubts about the man's integrity, no hint of some duplicitous agenda. But still, Smith was careful. It was the sorest point Smith had wrestled with, the contradiction to the training every senior officer had received. His words came out slowly.
General MacArthur has divided his army. The 10th Corps is to advance into North Korea, east of the mountains. The 8th Army is to advance to the west. This country is split in two by a backbone, a mountain range that will limit communication and logistics.
You don't approve?
I don't have approval.
I obey the orders I'm given.
If MacArthur is correct, this war will end rapidly without many more casualties. I must support that optimism.
Lowe shook his head, seemed frustrated.
Marines.
He leaned against the rail, faced Smith.
You may enjoy the luxury of your optimism, General. Others are not so fortunate. There is more at stake here than the destruction of the North Korean army.
General, do you know what MacArthur told the Joint Chiefs? Allow me to paraphrase. In exploiting the defeat of the enemy, our troops may cross the 38th parallel at any time. I regard all of Korea open for our military operations. He doesn't mention whether or not it's wise to divide his army in two. He doesn't talk about mountain ranges and backbones. He has rattled the president with his insistence that this cakewalk will end by Christmas. That kind of talk plays well in the newspapers, believe me. Plays well among the troops, too. But the larger concern is just how well that plays in Moscow.
Smith was becoming more uncomfortable now.
I don't know about such things. I've heard no reports of any Russian troops in Korea.
No, but there is real fear in Washington that the Soviets are waiting, watching, might use this as a provocation for a new war. There is concern that if MacArthur drives his people, your people, into China, the Soviets will respond in Europe. There are reports of thousands of Soviet tanks poised along the border between East and West Germany. Our allies are praying that this mess concludes as quickly as MacArthur insists it will. But if it doesn't, we're sitting on a big damn bomb, General. What happens here could ignite World War III.
Smith glanced around. No one within earshot. He looked again at Lowe, saw no drama in the man, his voice soft and steady.
Smith kept his voice, Lowe said. I've heard none of that. It won't happen. It can't. No one would go that far. President Truman doesn't want that, surely. He can prevent it. His orders must be obeyed.
The president knows that, of course.
The Joint Chiefs know that.
But, General, the greater concern in Washington is whether or not Douglas MacArthur knows that.
On October 15th, a surprised Douglas MacArthur received an invitation to meet with his commander-in-chief on Wake Island. The choice of location was seen by those in Washington as a concession to MacArthur,
that President Truman's journey would be much longer than that of his general. Whether MacArthur appreciated or even recognized the gesture, he flew to Wake, feeling as though the president had trespassed into MacArthur's private fiefdom. The meeting itself did nothing to dissuade MacArthur that Truman was playing politics with the war, that voices of opposition against the president in Washington had forced Truman to demonstrate that he was clearly involved in the hard decisions in Korea. MacArthur realized immediately that the meeting was more for show than for substance, a time-consuming annoyance. At a formal press conference immediately following, MacArthur repeated to the audience what he had said privately to Truman. His successes were virtually complete. MacArthur was adamant that there was little, if any, chance of the Chinese or the Soviet Union coming to the support of the North Koreans. MacArthur conveyed the message to the reporters whom Truman had brought across the ocean that the bulk of the American troops would be home by Christmas. Chapter 8. Sung. Peking, October 16, 1950. The room was quiet, all eyes on the older man, who kept his stare downward. Sung could feel the impatience around him, the younger officers chafing at the drudgery of yet another meeting, more clarification of orders they had expected to receive days before. Sung had been through all of this before, long before. The acceptance that the Army's resources were so often inferior to the enemy they faced. He had served alongside several of the men in this room, the senior commanders who had learned to endure sacrifice and privation. But others were young, knew little of what it had taken to fight the Japanese, or the great struggle against the Nationalists, the vast armies of Chiang Kai-shek. Sung glanced to one side, saw the young colonel, Lee, drumming his fingers on the arm of his chair. Sung tried to hold in his smile, thought, "You were not with us when these things were decided in tents, in shacks, when the enemy was shelling us. Now there is luxury, soft chairs, warm quarters. Of course you are impatient. You have learned none of the lessons that come from struggle or pain." Across the wide desk, the older man's head rose slowly, and he scanned the room, his eyes meeting Sung's for a brief moment. No smile from either of them. He spoke now, the words coming out in slow rhythm, precise, well rehearsed.
"Chairman Mao has been very explicit in his orders. We shall be efficient in our obedience of them. It is not the time for hasty judgments or questions that have already been answered."
Sung glanced at Lee, the younger man responding with silence, a bowed head. Good, Sung thought. It is not the time for unwise protest. He looked at the older man now, said,
"General Peng, we will obey. The mission will be one more great accomplishment for our leader. His army shall not disappoint him."
Peng looked at him, still no smile, a short nod. It was the game they had played for many years, a performance meant for the younger men, a script that could have come from Mao's own hand. Peng Duhuai was the overall commander of the Chinese military forces now, a position granted him by Mao Zedong as much a reward for loyalty as anything to do with Peng's expertise as a leader of troops. Sung was grateful for Peng's authority, respected the man as much now as he had 2 decades ago, the first time Sung Shi Lun had worn a uniform. In the mid-1930s, Sung had served with Peng during the Long March, a year-long military struggle that had become celebrated by every schoolchild in China. Then it was civil war, the beleaguered army under Mao fighting for survival, escaping destruction from the far superior arms and equipment of the Nationalists. The march had taken Mao's troops nearly 5,000 miles, allowing them to regroup, resupply, and eventually make war once more against the disorganized ranks of Chang's army. When the tide turned for good, Mao's success had elevated him to supreme leadership over the entire Chinese mainland. His authority now was unquestioned, fueled by his fierce claims of dedication to the people he ruled, to their history and ancient culture, and more important, their new place in a changing world. The peasants were told in unwavering terms, great boisterous speeches, that the entire world would become theirs, that the great revolution that had crushed Chiang and the nationalists would continue beyond China's borders. Most of China's enormous population were peasants, a great sea of humanity that had produced Mao himself, as well as many of the most successful generals from the war, including Peng Dehuai. No one in China was allowed to forget that Mao's glorious triumph had been accomplished by an army that had labored so long under the boot heels of the wealthy. It was that revolution that Mao insisted would spread to the peasantry of other lands, the message so very clear that no amount of Western corruption could stifle their voices, that everywhere the capitalists ruled there would be uprisings, spreading power to the powerless. For the experienced military officers who had finally defeated Chiang's vastly superior army, Mao's glorious predictions were embraced publicly, if not always in private. The officers understood what many of the peasants did not, that despite Mao's insistence that power rested with all the people, Mao was firmly and absolutely in charge. And with the wars now past, the old veterans, war horses like Peng Dehuai, understood that survival meant loyalty to Mao. Sung knew that Peng was as close to Mao as any man in the army, two old friends who had shared the struggles of so many brutal campaigns. Sung had been through that as well, though he was much younger. He had earned respect for his command of troops in the field, catching Mao's eye and Peng's as well. Now he commanded an entire army, the reward for his loyalty to the revolution and, more important, to Mao himself. But Sung's affections for Peng came from something deeper than mere obedience. He valued the older man's experience and wisdom in the political world as much as the military. He admired Peng's obvious dedication to Chairman Mao, that if Peng had ever disagreed with Mao's orders, it would never be revealed to any subordinate. The younger men around Sung had not yet fully grasped the value of that, some of their brashness seeping through when silence and discretion were far more useful. If there was a nagging uneasiness clouding Sung's own affections for General Peng, it was that some of the strategies that came down from Mao seemed to contradict experience, that the great dreams had clouded military necessity. Peng refused to acknowledge what Sung could see for himself, that as Mao's power solidified, Mao himself was changing. With the kind of absolute power that Mao enjoyed, the unquestioning obedience of all who served him, Mao had seemed to embrace his own infallibility. The most powerful man in China had also become the most wise. But many of them had memories of those days when Mao's judgment had been flawed. Poor planning, poor strategies employed in the struggle against Chiang Kai-shek. It was a curious mystery to Sung that Mao's authority was so completely accepted when the haphazard military decisions continued. Even as Peng's army maneuvered closer to the Yalu River, poised just above their border with North Korea, delays were ordered, betraying the uncertainties in Peking over just how they were to deal with events to the south. There were contradictions, awkward orders, the kind of hesitations that made military men nervous. For the officers, it was an exercise in patience and a wisdom of their own that kept them silent. When Mao's intentions were made clear, the military would respond. The questions were there, of course, spoken quietly in private places. Many of the officers around Sung puzzled by Peng Dehuai's rapid rise to the top command. Peng was respected, certainly, but his predecessor, Lin Biao, had long been Mao's favorite to command the army. In late September, as the first orders had come to maneuver closer to the Yalu River, Lin had suddenly disappeared. The official report claimed that Lin had fallen ill and, more surprisingly, had been sent to a hospital in the Soviet Union. Very soon, Lin had returned, named to command one of Mao's vast field armies. But he was subordinate now to Peng, no one in Peking offering an explanation. There were softly spoken rumors, of course, that Lin had made the deadly error of arguing with Mao, rejecting Mao's strategies for dealing with the problems that had erupted in Korea. The utter collapse of the North Korean army was a surprise, to be sure, but no one had expected that the Chinese would move into Korea to stand alongside Kim Il-sung as an equal partner. Now the public pronouncements barely mentioned the North Koreans at all, as though the Chinese troops were preparing only to defend their own border. With Peng now firmly in command, Sung would follow the orders he had been given, organizing his troops in their new camps along the Yalu, until Peng told him differently. Peng seemed weary, blinked several times, reached for a cup of tea. He seemed to move slowly on purpose, precise motions, keeping them all still, quiet. The silence was broken by a sudden rap on the door behind Sung, startling him. Peng kept his gaze on the tea, said in a soft voice, "Allow them to enter." The man entered quickly, the door closing behind him, and Peng said, "General Deng, welcome. I have been waiting for your report." Sung realized now that Peng had been delaying, keeping them waiting for Deng's arrival. He knew that Deng had been sent off on a discreet mission, but had asked no questions, even though Deng Hua was a subordinate to Sung, one of his corps commanders. Deng moved up in front of the room, faced them, acknowledged Sung now, a crisp, short nod. "Thank you, General Peng. If you will allow me to present my report." Peng sat back in the chair, the cup in his hand, seemed to know what the young general was going to say.
"Go ahead."
Deng took a deep breath, his hands clamped behind him.
"Gentlemen, I have just returned from a journey into Korea. My assignment was to monitor progress of the People's Army there to observe their situation. As you know, we have received reports that there have been reversals, that Kim Il-sung's forces have given away their advantages. We believe that few, if any, of Kim's troops remain south of the 38th parallel. These reports were most distressing, as you know. My orders were to determine just how dangerous those reverses have become." He turned, looked at Peng now, another nod from the older man. Deng faced them again. "I regret to report that my hosts, the senior command of the North Korean People's Army, had been instructed not to allow me to fulfill my mission. I was not allowed access to any field units and was not allowed to travel any farther south than Pyongyang. It was made very plain to me that my presence there was an unwelcome intrusion."
He turned again to Peng.
"General, I regret I did not complete my mission with any success. It is very clear that the North Korean People's Army is suffering a profound setback at the hands of the United Nations troops. The government of the People's Republic does not wish to reveal just how serious those reversals have become. Any further conclusion would be merely a guess on my part. I deeply regret my failure."
Sung saw anger in the young man's eyes, thought, "Yes, he is not a man who enjoys wasting his time." Peng said,
"General, you are excused. Do not embrace your mission as one of failure. Your report is most illuminating. It only confirms what Chairman Mao has anticipated from the start."
The guard pulled the door open, Deng marching out with crisp steps. Peng kept his eyes on his cup of tea, said,
"Chairman Mao has been most frustrated by Kim Il-sung. Our intelligence predicted that the United Nations troops would invade at the port of Incheon. We informed the North Koreans of that expectation and strongly advised them to make ready to resist such a move. They ignored our recommendations. We know the results. Chairman Mao has no intentions of repeating such a mistake. The North Koreans have chosen to fight their war on their own terms, terms that do not concern us. Until now, the North Koreans have been wholly dependent on the Soviets for arms and supplies. But the Soviets have recognized their mistake as well, and from what we can determine, have withdrawn much of that support."
Peng paused, sipped at the tea, looked out at them, scanning the room. Sung waited for more, could see a frown on Peng's face.
"You have already been ordered to position your troops along our border. At first, this was to be a defensive posture, so as to prevent the United Nations troops, particularly the Americans, from pursuing an aggressive course that would threaten Chinese sovereignty. We have repeatedly expressed our deepest concerns that should United Nations troops cross over the 38th parallel, invading the territory of North Korea, the Chinese people would interpret that as a direct threat to our own interests. As you know, the American puppets who call themselves the Army of the Republic of Korea have already crossed the border and are taking advantage of the disgraceful retreat by the North. Despite the unwillingness of Kim Il-sung to provide information as to his own failures, our own intelligence indicates that the Americans have followed in their wake. These reports have confirmed that units of the American 1st Cavalry of General Walker's 8th Army have violated North Korean territory. We are certain that this is only the beginning. Chairman Mao continues to be most adamant that such a violation is a direct threat to the sovereignty of our own border and shall be dealt with in absolute terms. We do not fear the puppet army of South Korea, nor do we fear the possible loss of Pyongyang. The greater danger is that those who pull the strings are using this conflict in Korea as a pretense for a far more insidious plan. General MacArthur, who commands the puppet forces of the United Nations, has been indiscreet in his belligerence to Chinese sovereignty. Chairman Mao is convinced that General MacArthur and those who support him from above wish to engage the Chinese people in a war.
Sung absorbed what Peng was saying, the others seemingly surprised. To one side, another of the young corps commanders spoke up.
"General, what actions are we to take regarding the crisis that has directly befallen North Korea? Are they not our allies?"
Sung winced at the question, saw a glimmer of disgust on Peng's face.
"There shall be no actions taken with regard to the government of the People's Republic of Korea."
The man stood now, said,
"But are we not committed to assisting Kim Il-sung in the event of such a tragedy? I had thought..."
Peng pointed a bony finger at the man.
"You do not think, General." Chairman Mao has communicated to the People's Republic that if they wish to be rescued, they can beseech their comrades in Moscow. Chairman Mao has no great regard for Kim Il-sung, and neither do I. The issue is not merely Korea. It is the threat to our border. Is that not apparent to all of you?
There were nods. The young man beside Sung seated again. Sung glanced at him, saw embarrassment, thought, that was not a good idea. You just revealed that you perhaps have some personal interest in what happens in Korea. I wonder what kind of interest. Someone else shall no doubt ask that same question. To Sung's other side, Lee stood, stiff-backed, said, General Peng, is it possible, in Chairman Mao's estimation, that the Korean People's Army can continue their struggle by means of guerrilla tactics? Perhaps the Army of the North might still be capable of eliminating the Americans' threat to our border by a vigorous defense of their own country. Peng shook his head.
Chairman Mao does not believe the leadership of the North Korean People's Republic is capable of inspiring their people to such a goal. There is only one issue now. You will receive final orders shortly that will instruct you on exactly when your troops are to advance across the Yalu River and make preparations for the destruction of any forces threatening our borders. It is wholly to our advantage to strike at those troops before they can strike at us. Chairman Mao has told me to expect the final order to be issued at any time. It is therefore essential that you put your troops on alert, prepared to move quickly.
Lee seemed surprised, leaned forward.
We are crossing the border? We are to directly engage the United Nations forces? Will the Soviets honor their pledge to assist us with heavy artillery and air power? Without their assistance, we are at some disadvantage in weaponry. Engaging the Americans, sit down!
Peng's voice was loud. No room for argument. Lee obeyed without speaking. Peng looked at Sung now.
This meeting is concluded. General Sung, you will remain. The rest of you return to your commands. Orders will follow very soon.
The others stood, the door opening, a hint of cool air drifting into the stuffiness of the room. Sung kept his seat, did not watch the others, kept his eyes on Peng, who sipped again from the teacup. In a short moment the room was empty, the guard leaving as well, the door closing. Peng closed his eyes briefly, Sung keeping silent. After a moment, Peng said,
There is little wisdom in any of them. The young, worst of all. But even the experienced ones have forgotten the value of loyalty.
Sung shook his head.
I do not believe that to be true. I have heard nothing of disloyalty to Chairman Mao.
Peng shrugged.
Maybe, but there is uncertainty. They do not trust in our ability to crush our enemies.
Do you? Peng laughed, a glance toward the door.
Of course I do. Chairman Mao wills it, and it will be so.
Sung was careful now. He knew Peng enjoyed his company, seemed to treat him as a son as much as a subordinate. It was the same with many of the veterans, the men who had learned to sacrifice for the greater cause. Peng said,
You have been hungry, yes? I mean hungry, starving. You know I have shared such conditions, as have you. Yes, and you have seen the dead gathering around you. Men whose weakness betrayed them, whose spirit would not keep them alive, men who could not embrace sacrifice. I suppose so. Yes? We lost 9 of 10 men on the long march. It is not necessary for you to remind me of our history, sir. 9 of 10. Yes. The 10th man. You, me, Chairman Mao. We know what victory means. Not some storybook slicing the head off the dragon. Not merely vanquishing your rival so you may enjoy the sweetness of his woman. Victory. The look in your enemy's eye as you slide the knife into his heart, as you steal his life. The smell of his blood.
Sung saw a hard spark in Peng's eyes, something he had seen before.
Sir, do you doubt my will?
Peng laughed.
No, my friend, nor do I doubt your loyalty. To Chairman Mao and those around him, that is what matters most. I fear that very soon it will be more about your skills as a soldier.
Peng paused.
Colonel Li's concerns are accurate. We were hopeful that the Soviets would honor their commitment to provide the military equipment that would balance the scales against the Americans. They have now reneged on that promise.
Sung was stunned.
They have reneged? They assured us Soviet assurances are like rivers of mud. Soil yourself in it if you wish, but do not expect to drink the water. The North Korean army has become useless, and Chairman Stalin has turned his eyes to other causes. All they offer us now are advisors, Stalin's toadies, who have pledged to provide assistance where they observe its need. I suspect, as does Chairman Mao, that these men have been ordered to remain blind to our needs. We shall welcome them into our camp. Allow them to see just what our weaknesses might be.
It sounds as if you are describing spies. Peng laughed.
And so I am. Chairman Mao certainly believes it so. Here I disagree with him, if only on a minor point. I still believe the Soviets can be helpful to us, and it is in their interest to assist us against our shared enemies. One day they might require some assistance from us in Europe. Chairman Mao is not concerned with a world so far away. But the revolution will one day consume all men in all lands. On that, Chairman Mao and I agree completely. We must know who our friends are.
Sung absorbed all that Peng was telling him.
I am not so familiar with such lofty things. I prefer being a soldier.
Peng nodded, a friendly smile.
You are not wrong, my friend. Very soon now, soldiers will be far more valuable than philosophers. The Americans are coming, and we must do what we can to obliterate their threat. I do not require Chairman Mao's wisdom to tell me that. Like Mao, I smell when the enemy believes he is winning, when he convinces himself he is strong, and so he becomes reckless. There is celebration in MacArthur's headquarters, jubilation that they have crushed the army of Kim Il-sung. Now they will march northward singing their songs, waving their flags. Did we not warn them what would happen if they threatened us? Surely they do not wish to risk a war that could engulf all of Asia.
Peng opened a drawer, held up a piece of paper.
This is a letter offered to me by Chairman Mao's secretaries. I am grateful to be included in these correspondences. Now, I share this with you.
He handed the letter to Sung, who took the paper. Read slowly.
I'm not sure what this means. Look at the bottom. The signature of the Indian ambassador, Panikkar. Our people made very clear to the Indian consul that they should communicate our concerns to the Americans. Minister Chuen Lai made very clear on several occasions, through several avenues, that we will not accept any threat to our borders, none at all. Minister Chu stated very plainly that if there was any such threat, we would respond with vigorous force. There was nothing vague about our intentions, none of that ridiculous diplomatic wordplay. Our concerns were clear and precise. If you threaten our border, we will defend our sovereignty. Ambassador Panikkar was most willing to communicate our concerns to anyone in the West who would listen.
Sung scanned the letter.
He says here that they would not listen. He says he was dismissed. Ignored, more accurately. The Americans responded by ordering their troops northward. I don't understand.
Peng reached for the teacup again.
The Americans believe they can take any action they choose. I have never seen a people with such swagger. They defeated the Japanese, the Germans. In the end, Kim Il-sung was little more than a mosquito. And so they believe they are invincible.
Sung put the paper back on the desk.
They have the atomic bomb.
Peng pounded a fist, rattling the teacup.
Yes! That only makes them more arrogant. Incredibly arrogant. A big bomb capable of destroying a whole city in one moment. We are a nation of farms. How many bombs will it require to destroy all of that? So the mighty Americans can kill 1 million of us. Perhaps 2 million. Perhaps 10 million. And then, we know of sacrifice, Shilun. 9 of 10. Remember? Chairman Mao knows more than anyone on this earth what is required to win a war against a superior foe. All those big bombs and fast planes and mighty cannons. But the Americans lack belief. We are fighting for revolution. The Americans are fighting for what? To support a corrupt government in the South? They did that once before, did they not? Chiang Kai-shek sits in his counterfeit palace in Taiwan, alive only because the Americans allow it. Now it is Syng Man Rhee, kept alive by fat American artillery. There is no justice to what they do, and that is why we will prevail. They fight for a weak cause. There is purity in us, in our people, in our claim to become a mighty nation again.
He paused, seemed to catch his breath.
General Sung, the final order will come as I told the others, but I can tell you this right now. You will continue to command the 9th Army Group. You will position your forces at the most convenient crossings of the Yalu River to advance southward on the 19th of October. You will use all means to prevent the enemy from knowing your intentions or your deployment. You will spread your forces to the south and east, protecting the left